Well, tonight's question is a difficult question. If God is good, if God is loving, if God is all-powerful and all-knowing, then how do we explain evil and suffering and pain? Right? How are these things compatible? And usually this question is provoked in our lives, usually by instances of pain and suffering. I remember as a college student beginning to ask this question in a very serious way. I grew up in the church, and I was in Southern California at a small Southern Baptist church, and met this man right here, Dan Vasquez. He was actually the senior pastor at our church. And the way I met Dan was through his son, Danny, right? And obviously, you know, you kind of get a little, late 80s picture here of the family. But so Danny and I became friends in junior high. My family was looking for a church, and Danny and I became friends, and so then he invited me over to, you know, to his dad's church. So we started going to the church. And then Danny and I became really good friends. And his dad, Dan Sr., was the pastor. And there's Danny and I in junior high school. And then actually, Danny and I recently kind of reunited. This is Danny and I about a year ago. And apparently, someone continued to grow beyond junior high and someone didn't, right? But so we were best friends throughout junior high into high school. We actually shared a birthday, so we always did our birthdays together. And through that friendship, of course, I got to spend a lot of time at the Vasquez family home. And not only did, of course, I get to know Danny, but I got to know Pastor Dan. I got to see kind of the family from the inside out. And Pastor Dan was a beloved pastor at our church. And I was able to see kind of behind the scenes that the man who was on this, you know, on the stage, the man behind the pulpit, the man who was teaching us, who was our pastor, was real and genuine. And he was one of those guys that was sacrificial and faithful and just was a tremendous model of a pastor, right? A faithful pastor serving his congregation faithfully. Well, my freshman year in college, Pastor Dan was diagnosed with melanoma cancer. And so our church really mounted a campaign to just pray and pray for his healing. And that battle took place for a good year where he was battling cancer. And we, our church spread the word, we had people all over the country praying. We had even other people in other parts of the world who were praying that God would heal Pastor Dan. His situation got worse through that year. And eventually he was on bed rest at home, hospice care. And I was doing an internship at my church, so I was actually out with our associate pastor. And we were running some errands. We got a phone call from the church secretary. And she called and said that Dan had stopped breathing. The paramedics had to come and resuscitate him. And they rushed him over to the ICU and that we needed to get over to the hospital. So we rushed right over to the hospital. And that was like early afternoon. And as we got there, other people from our church were already arriving as word kind of spread. And people from our church started filling up the visitors' room there and were spilling out into the hallways. And soon enough, the hospital was filled with people from our church who were just praying, really, for a miracle that that Pastor Dan would be healed. I remember Danny was at the hospital, his son. And it was probably around 5:30, Danny and I took off. We were hungry, so we walked down the street to a local fast food place there. And I remember sitting in this fast food place with Danny, and he was talking to me about the possibility of losing his dad that very evening. And it was just this really surreal moment of having a conversation with my best friend and him really considering the fact that, you know, this may be the last time that he spends with his dad. And so we went back to the hospital, and Pastor Dan was unconscious, and there was no progress, and this went into the evening, and tons of people from our church just stayed there and prayed. And I remember actually, I was sitting outside of the ICU on some on the tile, just kind of praying and thinking, but I was within earshot of the room, so I could actually, from where I was sitting out in the hallway, I could hear Dan's heart monitor. And I remember sitting there and, you know, hearing the beep, 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 and then hearing it flatline. And I remember hearing it flatline, and then I remember hearing the sound of a sound that I had not experienced before, but it was a sound of human wailing as Bev, his wife, Jody, and Jenny, and Danny were in the room when their dad, who was about, I think he was 43 years old, died of melanoma cancer. And that experience provoked this question. It's going through that and watching, you know, someone who I was close to and seeing my best friend's dad suffer and die, it provoked this question. Particularly given the kind of life that Dan lived, you know, and my questions to God were, God, if here's a man, right? Here's a man who wasn't the bad guy, right? He was the good guy. He sacrificially gave his life for the ministry. I mean, this guy did so much for people all over. And so, if you're good and you're powerful, why wouldn't you heal him? Why wouldn't you do that? And that's when I really wrestled with it. And I'm sure we could go around this room. And there are all kinds of stories in this room of pain and suffering and times of wrestling with God in this question. And so it's often provoked by living life. So this is not a question that's unique to Christians. This is a question that every human being wrestles with. In fact, the skeptic wants to take this question and actually use it as ammunition against the Christian worldview. The skeptic, like Sam Harris, who's a prominent atheist in our culture, he wants to put it this way. He says, either God can do nothing to stop catastrophes, or he doesn't care to, or he doesn't exist. So God is either impotent, evil, or imaginary. Take your pick and choose wisely. And so the skeptic poses this to the believer as a dilemma, as a challenge that needs to be answered. And so we want to spend some time thinking carefully through this. And now, I actually take great confidence in Christianity's ability to meet these kinds of challenges. C.S. Lewis, in an essay that he wrote called The Weight of Glory, he says this. He says, I believe in Christianity as I believe that the sun has risen. Not only because I see it, but because by it, I see everything else. Do you understand what Lewis is saying there? He's saying, not only do we have direct evidence of Christianity, just like we can go outside any day of the week, look outside and see the sun, right? You can see you can directly perceive the sun. But I'm guessing that's not how you often determine that the sun is risen, right? You don't walk outside, go, oh yeah, there's a sun. Okay, yeah, we're good to go. Right? No, you typically walk outside and you see that it's light out. You see everything around you. And in the same way, Lewis is saying that is one thing that testifies to the truthfulness of Christianity is that it makes sense of the world around us. It brings what we call coherence. It takes the different pieces and questions of life and gives them meaning and makes sense of them. And I think when it comes to this question, as I examine not just the Christian response on this, but other responses, it seems to me that Christianity really is the worldview that makes the best sense of this entire issue. Now, if you know anything about Lewis's life, you know that Lewis was no stranger to pain and to suffering. In fact, in 1940, he wrote this book, The Problem of Pain, where he really kind of dove into the intellectual questions. And he really looked at the question of, is evil compatible with the existence of God? And he deals with the intellectual questions. It's a really great, great read. But for those of us who know, Lewis came to marriage late in life. He married this woman, Joy Davidman, in 1957. She dies about 3 years after their marriage of cancer. And in 1961, there's another book that's published under a pseudonym, and it was entitled A Grief Observed. Of course, we know that Lewis actually wrote this. And this book is a very different book than the one he wrote 20 years prior. This book is really his journalings through the experience of pain. And in this book, you get his raw emotion. You hear him, you hear how he's feeling and what's going on inside. In fact, one line from the book is this. It tells you where he's at in the kind of the beginning of this book. He says, but go to him, go to God when your need is desperate, when all other help is vain. And what do you find? A door slammed in your face and a sound of bolting and double bolting on the inside. After that, silence. Wow. This is the guy who 20 years prior wrote this incredible apologetic dealing with the problem of evil. But here you get the experience, the emotion. And actually, I think these two books are great to read side by side. And they help us to understand that there are actually several different problems of evil. We want to distinguish between what we call the emotional problem of evil. The emotional problem of evil, that is our experience. That is actually walking through evil and suffering. That's experiencing pain. Sometimes it's referred to as the existential problem of pain. But when we are in the midst of evil and suffering, emotion can overwhelm us. Right? When I watched my best friend lose his father, he was and his family, they were overwhelmed with emotion. And what do you do in that situation? That is not the time to come running in with all of your apologetic answers. That is not the time maybe to necessarily just come running in and just quote Bible verses. But when someone is in the midst of pain and suffering, we have to be careful to lovingly walk with them through that. You look at the book of Job, right? A book, of course, on suffering. And you see, of course, in chapter 1 what Job goes through, and then you see the response of his friends. In chapter 2, we read this. Now, when Job's three friends heard of all this adversity that had come upon him, they came each one from his own place. Eliphaz the Temanite, Bildad the Shuhite, and Zophar the Naamathite. And they made an appointment together to come to sympathize with him and comfort him. When they lifted up their eyes at a distance and did not recognize him, they raised their voices and wept. And each of them tore his robe, and they threw dust over their heads toward the sky. Then they sat down on the ground with him for 7 days and 7 nights with no one speaking a word to him, for they saw that his pain was very great. What a response. That his friend saw his pain, instead of coming and then trying to solve it and throw answers out, what do? They just came and they sat in silence with him for a week. That's what we call the ministry of presence, where you're just present with someone. Nothing has to be said. You're just present, and you just love them by being there with them, by listening, by weeping with them, by crying with them. And so oftentimes that is the proper response to pain and suffering, is to walk lovingly and graciously with people. It's not to just dump our answers on them. There may be a time to come with answers and to explore that. But first, when our friends and our neighbors and our family are in the midst of it, we need to come alongside and just be with them and walk with them and hurt with them and maybe let them even rage against God like Lewis did in A Grief Observed. I think God can contain their pain. And so that is an important thing to distinguish up front, is that when we deal with the emotional problem, the experience, when we walk with people through this, there is a different response that is required. Now, the questions will come, and so we also want to highlight that there is a second problem. So you have the emotional problem, but you also do have the intellectual problem. And in fact, the intellectual problem can be divided into two separate problems. Philosophers will talk about the logical problem and the evidential problem. Now, for our purposes, I think on your outline you have a kind of a response to the logical problem. I'm not going to spend time there because most of really the action on that this particular question has to do with the evidential problem. And what is the evidential problem? Well, it's simply the idea that there is so much evil and suffering in the world that it really counts as evidence against God's existence. So it's probably the case, according to the skeptic, that there is no God. So I think here's a really helpful way to kind of picture this. Picture it in terms of scales, okay? And so what the skeptic does is the skeptic comes and says, okay, on this side of the scale, we have evil and we have pain and we have suffering. And we give instances and examples of that. And if this is what the scale looks like, the scale tips in favor of the skeptic's position. Given evil, pain, and suffering, there probably is no God. It's probably not likely that God actually exists. And so here's what we want to do for the rest of our time. We want to see if there's anything that we can say in response, if there's anything we can put on the other side of the scale that would not only counterbalance this, but it would actually still tip the scales in favor of God's existence. So that's what we're going to do for the rest of our time. Now, oftentimes when you have an issue like this, and you think, well, where should I start on this? The starting point for many of these kind of things is definitions, is getting clarity on exactly what we're talking about, right? And so the skeptic may pose the question like this. Well, if God is the creator of everything, doesn't that mean that God is also the creator of evil? Right? And at first glance, we might think, well, yeah, okay, how do I get out of that one? Or can I get out of that one? Or is it the case that, yeah, I'm going to have to say that God is the author of evil? And if so, doesn't that count against his character? I mean, how can you say that a God who authors evil is also a loving God? Right? So it seems we're in a bit of a dilemma here, and I think the way out is to first ask the question, well, what do we mean by evil? What is evil? How many of us have thought carefully about evil? And I don't mean just giving examples, because typically when you ask someone what is evil, they'll give you an example, right? Well, child abuse or murder or some kind of injustice, those are examples of evil. But no, but why is that evil? Give me a definition that helps me to understand why you take something like that to be evil. And I think one of the ways that we can kind of help understand the nature of evil is by drawing a couple of analogies, okay? So before we define evil, I want to define a couple of other things. The first thing I want you to define is a donut hole, all right? So what is a donut hole? In fact, let me ask this question. How many of you in here have actually eaten a donut hole before? Anyone eaten a donut hole? Okay. This is what you might say is a donut hole. Okay, I want to correct your inaccuracies, because this is not a donut hole. This technically is a donut ball, all right, if you will. This is a donut ball. This is not a donut hole. Now you're sitting there going, well, what's a donut hole? Well, let's be very precise here. A donut hole is the place where there is no donut. You might want to write that one down, okay? A donut hole is the place where there is no donut. Or another way of putting it is a donut hole is the absence of donuts. All right, now obviously I've given a lot of thought to this. This is what you do when you get a master's degree in philosophy, okay? You think about these things a little too much. But I want you, here's the key point, I want you to see that we actually refer to things that don't actually exist. We say donut hole, but what are we referring to? We're not referring to something that has real status. We're referring to the absence of something. In the same way, if I were to ask you, what is a shadow? Right? What is a shadow? Someone pick up your shadow and show it to us. Right? A shadow is not that kind of thing. Again, a shadow is the absence of light. And so we refer to things like these all the time. But they're not real things. Right? They're then the absence of something. Now, let's go back to the question of evil, right? What is evil? What if someone takes a knife and plunges that knife into the human body? Is that evil? Well, let's say that person is a thief, and they stab a woman to take her purse. Would we say then that the knife that was used in the stabbing is evil? It doesn't seem to me that we would say the knife is evil. That actually, that same blade might be able to be used by a doctor or a surgeon to remove a cancerous tumor. In that situation, would we say, well, the knife is good? Well, no, we wouldn't say that that object itself is either good or evil. it seems like in one instance you have a proper relationship between the body and the knife, in another instance you have an improper relationship. In the first instance you have an absence of goodness, where in the second instance you have goodness in place. So, now hopefully you can kind of see where we're going with this. What is evil? Evil is not some thing. Right? You're not going to walk outside tonight and trip over some evil. Okay? You can't go down to the deli and order a pound of evil, right? It's not that kind of thing. Evil is not a thing. Evil is the absence of something. Evil is the absence of good. There's a simple definition for evil. It's the absence of good. Here's another way to put it. It's a departure from the way things ought to be. Evil is a departure from the way things ought to be. Now, what this helps us to do is it helps us to offer a first response. And it actually helps us to answer that question that the skeptic might pose. Well, isn't God the author or the creator of evil? Well, no. Evil is not a thing that was created. It was brought into existence, but it was not created by God. Evil is something that is brought into existence by man. And this is what we call the classical free will defense. It's the idea that evil is an intruder into man's relationship with God. Now, in God's creative act, as he creates human creatures, he endows them with human freedom, freedom of the will. We take this to be a very good thing. This is something that dignifies human beings, right? We know that when human beings have freedom to act, that's a very dignifying process versus being enslaved or being forced to do something. And so we know that human freedom is a good, but human freedom makes evil possible. And so Lewis actually addresses an objection that may be raised at this point in his book, The Problem of Pain. He says this, he said, God created things which had free will. That means creatures which can go wrong or right. Some people think they can imagine a creature which was free but had no possibility of going wrong. But I can't. If a thing is free to be good, it's also free to be bad. And free will is what has made evil possible. Why then did God give them free will? Because free will, though it makes evil possible, is also the only thing that makes possible any love or goodness or joy worth having. Right? And so, if you create a creature with free will, that just entails the possibility that that creature can actually, if they have genuine freedom, they can actually choose something other than that which is good. And so this is the classical free will defense. And so that's one response that can be offered to explain the existence of evil. Evil was not something that originates with God. It actually, moral evil originates with mankind. Now, oftentimes, this is where Christians stop. And they kind of just offer this kind of very flimsy free will defense, kind of, oh, free will, and they throw that out there. And I want to say, look, I think free will is a part of the solution. It's an important part. It helps us to explain the origination of evil. It helps us to see that God is not the author of evil. But I think there's much more that we can say as well. I want you to look at this as kind of a cumulative response. There's not just one answer, but there are a multitude of answers that help us make sense of this. So free will is a good starting point, but we want to say more. And here's, I think, the second thing that we can say. The second thing we can say is that God may have good reasons for allowing evil. God may, and the way philosophers would put it is, God has morally sufficient reasons for allowing the kind of evil he does. Because we want to say that if we hold to some kind of doctrine of sovereignty, right, that God is somehow in control, well then, maybe he's not the cause of evil, but he certainly permits it or allows it in some sense. And I think that's right if you hold to a doctrine of sovereignty. So he's not the direct cause, but in some sense he allows or permits it. Why would he permit such a thing? Well, he may actually have good reasons. Now, in order, I think, to get a full grasp of this answer, we have to think a little bit about human finitude, or human finiteness, if you will, right? The fact that human beings are limited. We are limited, of course, in our knowledge. And there was actually a movie that came out probably 12 years ago. How many of you saw the movie Sliding Doors with Gwyneth Paltrow? Anybody see that one? Like, well, two of us, all right? I know that's kind of a chick flick. What? No, I'm just kidding. You and I are the only, and you were the only ones who saw it. Okay, so here's what you need to do. Go to Amazon Prime, I think, Prime Video, and I think it's on there. You can watch it. It's actually a pretty fascinating movie. And I'm going to actually show you the very first minute and a half of the movie to see. So I want you to see how they set this up, because I think it actually gives us a little insight into our limited ability to know things. So this is the first minute and a half of the movie. Okay, did you catch what's going on there? From this point forward, the movie really splits into kind of two movies. And so you see in the first instance, right, you see she is, she kind of has to go around that little girl, and so she barely misses the subway train, right? And then it rewinds it, and then shows that the parent moves the child, so she gets that extra split second, gets her arm in the door, and is able to make it on. And so then it shows, the rest of the movie plays out what happens in her life if she makes the train, and what happens in her life if she misses the train. And you think this is really, I mean, this is kind of it seems to be fair, somewhat of a insignificant event, right? It's not a life-changing event that you missed the train or not. Well, that's what you would think. But as the movie splits, it shows just how the dominoes fall. And you never would have expected that that little incident of making the train or missing the train actually sets her life into two completely different trajectories. One seems to be filled with all kinds of happiness, and one seems to be filled with all kinds of tragedy. From this just one little instant. And then at the end, there's a huge twist that kind of throws everything off again. And the point is, as I watched that, and you know, you saw this happen, you just never would have been able to anticipate. And as I reflect on that, it actually makes me think, well, yeah, that's actually the kind of position that we're in as human beings, isn't it? We don't know how every small event of our life ends up playing out. We don't know how one thing can lead to great tragedy or great joy, even though it might be a small event. And so the insight here is that you and I are limited in our capacity to know things. And is it not possible that from our human perspective, we may not understand why God may permit something, but that does not mean that He would not have reasons that justify the things that He allows. I think another good analogy, it's a rough analogy, but I think it's an analogy that again sheds light on this, is a parent's perspective versus a child's perspective. Right? God has given me five kids. I have three girls and two boys. And at some point in their lives, I've had to take them to the doctor. And it's very early on in their little young lives. And all of our kids, I don't know about your kids, but all my kids when they were born, they were all just fat, chubby, babies. They all look like this. This is Jonah, my youngest, right? He's got the body of a god, don't you think? Buddha's the god I was talking about, so. But this is what our kids look like. And I remember taking Micah, my son right there on my right-hand side. I remember taking Micah the first time for his doctor's appointment. It was about 4 months in. And he was just a fat, chubby baby, just like Jonah here. And we took him in for some shots. And I remember going in and having the nurse, take Micah, and she's weighing him, and she's doing all that. But then she sets him down on that doctor's table with that white, crinkly paper, right? And she says, okay, Dad, I want you to undress Micah down to his diaper. Leave his diaper on, but take his clothes off. So I did that. And so Micah's laying there on the table, and she says, okay, Dad, I want you to hold his legs down. Okay? And so I grab his legs to secure his legs. And of course, as I grab his legs, I'm looking right at him. And I remember Micah, he looks right into my eyes, right? And there's Dad, there's safety, there's love, and he's starting to smile at me. And then the nurse says, okay, Mom, I want you to grab his arms and hold his arms down, right? Secure this little guy down. And then that nurse, that mean nurse, she wheels over this little metal tray table with four syringes on it, right? And those needles are like that big. I mean, they're huge. And what does she do? She takes that needle, and as I'm holding my son down, here I am complying. I'm actively involved in this great evil. She grabs that needle and just bam, right? Throws it in his fat, chubby thigh. And of course, I think because he had so much fat, there's that moment where like he's got this needle sticking out of his leg, but it just hasn't, you know, registered in the brain yet. He's smiling at me, needle sticking out of his leg. But then as I'm looking at him, I'm waiting for that face to change. And sure enough, that face changes from smiling to, ah, right? And he just starts screaming and crying. And then it's like one needle out, grab the other one. Boom, next needle out, next one. And there were four different shots. By the end of that, not only is Micah crying, but I'm crying. Like, what did I do to my kid? All right. Now, now think about it for a second. Now, why would I, as a parent, allow my kid to go through some kind of shots like that, or any kind of doctor procedure that might hurt them or bring pain? Why would I do that? Would you look at a dad who does that and instantly say that is an evil dad? Well, of course not, right? Because you know that from a father's perspective, I am morally justified, aren't I? I have good reasons to permit that pain in my child's life. And even as my kids are older, as they've gotten older and I've had to take them to doctors, I remember Ella, she's hanging on my arm, on my shoulder right there. She's 5 years old, had to take her to the doctors, right? And I remember my wife saying, I'm not going, you're going, you take her, kind of thing. I was like, all right, I'll do it. And so I remember driving there, and on the way there, I'm having the conversation with Ella. Because I'm not going to surprise her with this. I want to try and prepare her. And so I'm telling her, okay, honey, you're going to have to get one shot today. And her first response is, no, Dad, I don't want a shot. Dad, shots hurt. I don't want that. No. And so what did I do? What did I say in response? Well, I said, Ella, I just want you to know that Dad has morally sufficient reasons to do this to you. Okay, so maybe I didn't put it in those terms, right? But that's essentially what I said. I tried to explain to her that there's this greater good, right? There's this health, this protection. And so that's why Dad's going to let you get a shot. I mean, I don't want you to get hurt, but this is going to be, there's going to be a good result at the end of this. Trust me. When I gave her my reasons, what do you think her response was? She said, oh, okay, Dad, I totally understand now. Let's go. Let's do this. No. It didn't matter how much explaining I did. She said, no, I still don't want the shots. I don't want the pain, right? Now think about it. That clearly communicates that there's a gap in understanding, a gap in knowledge between the 5-year-old child and the adult parent. And if there's a gap in knowledge between the 5-year-old child and the adult parent, what's the gap in knowledge between finite human creatures and an infinite God? Now, I'm not suggesting we can't ask questions of God. I'm just saying that if God is who he is, if he's an omniscient being, then he certainly has a perspective that we know nothing about. And we could think of all kinds of illustrations where you and I had a limited perspective on some event or some person, and when we got more information, it shed completely different light on the situation. And so in this situation we find ourselves in a place where we are not omniscient. And it seems to me there's no way that the skeptic can say that God does not have morally sufficient reasons from our vantage point. Lewis put it this way in The Problem of Pain. He says, what do people mean when they say, I'm not afraid of God because I know he is good? Have they never even been to a dentist? Right? And the point is, a dentist has morally sufficient reasons to cause us pain. But that doesn't mean the dentist is bad. And so we have a second response, and the second response is that there are good reasons that God may have to permit evil and suffering, even if we don't know what those things are. Now, I think there are probably testimonies in here of people who could get up and say, yeah, there was this time when we went through this massive amount of pain and suffering, 4, 5, 6, maybe 10 years later, looking back on that, you have a whole different perspective on it. Looking back on Pastor Dan's death from cancer, I have a whole different perspective on it. So does his family. As we saw certain things happen through that experience. And so we've got two responses. Let's add a third response. Here it is. Evil is actually evidence for God. Evil is evidence for God. How many of you in here have played organized sports? Raise your hand if you played organized sports. Okay, keep your hands up if you played the best sport of all time. Okay, you got soccer players in here? Soccer players?
Yeah.
Is soccer big in Montana? Not really. Okay, whoops. All right, well, I played soccer all my life. Grew up playing soccer, first on the East Coast when I lived in Maryland, then in Southern California. I played through high school, and I've been continue to kind of be involved in like men's leagues and adult soccer leagues. And I want you to imagine one night, let's say I show up Monday night to my soccer game, okay? And let's say I show up late. Now, typically what would happen is the referee would gather both teams before the game, kind of go over some instructions, you shake each other's hands, and then you start the game, right? Well, let's say I show up late, like 2 minutes before the game's about to start, and the teams are already gathered at the center circle, so I'm missing the instructions. I just have enough time to throw on my shin guards, my cleats, my socks. And I get onto the field just in time for the referee to blow the whistle and start the game. And so a teammate passes me the ball, right? I collect the ball, I start to dribble. And let's say someone from the opposite, from the opponent, opposing team, they come sliding in. They slide tackle me. And except they don't touch the ball. Instead, their cleats go directly into the back of my calf, and I go down really hard. Okay. When I get up, who am I looking for? Okay, some of you are like, the guy, right? You're looking for the guy. Okay, let me clarify. If I don't hear a whistle, right, who am I looking for? I'm looking for the referee. I'm going to make an appeal. I'm going to say, ref, why didn't you blow your whistle? Why didn't you call a foul? Now imagine the ref looks at me and says, oh, hey, you were the player who missed the opening instructions. Well, both teams decided that in tonight's soccer game, they wanted to play the game with no rules. And everyone was going to be able to make up their own rules. And so I didn't blow the whistle because who am I to judge? There are no rules. Now think about it for a second. That's a legitimate response from a referee in a game where there are no rules. Because in a game where there are no rules, there are no fouls. There are no penalties. Now take that analogy and apply it to the universe. In a universe where there are no rules, there are no fouls. In a universe where there is no good, there is no evil. But this is one of the great challenges the skeptic offers, right? Evil is an argument against God's existence. In fact, this is Richard Dawkins, probably the world's most famous atheist. He wrote a book called The God Delusion. And Richard Dawkins says this. He says, the God of the Old Testament is arguably the most unpleasant character in all fiction. Jealous and proud of it. A petty, unjust, unforgiving control freak, a vindictive, bloodthirsty ethnic cleanser, a misogynistic, homophobic, racist, infanticidal, genocidal, filicidal, pestilential, megalomaniacal, sadomasochistic, capriciously malevolent bully. Man, Richard, how do you really feel? Come here. I mean, don't hold back. This is actually probably the most famous line in this book, right? And what if you were to boil his objection down to just a short sentence, what would it be? God is evil. God is evil. God is bad. Now, what we have from Richard Dawkins is not just this book, but he's got a large body of work, right? He's a famous biologist from Oxford, famous evolutionist. In an earlier book that he wrote called A River Out of Eden, he actually talks about his evolutionary views and how they apply to the universe. And this is one of the things he says in that book, A River Out of Eden. He says, in a universe of electrons and selfish genes, blind physical forces and genetic replication, some people are going to get hurt. Other people are going to get lucky, and you won't find any rhyme or reason in it, nor any justice. The universe we observe has precisely the properties we should expect if there is at bottom no design, no purpose, no evil, and no good. Nothing but blind, pitiless indifference. Do you see how these two claims in these two different books are incompatible? In this, he says, the universe governed by blind evolutionary forces, our conclusion from that is that there is no purpose, there is no design, there is no good and evil. He says this explicitly. And yet, his complaint against the God of the Old Testament is that the God of the Old Testament is evil. But how can you make that claim if you have no standard of goodness? In fact, Lewis, a former atheist who comes to Christianity later, after kind of finding rational arguments and also having his imagination captured, he said this. He said, my argument as an atheist, my argument against God was that the universe seemed to be cruel and unjust. But how had I got this idea of just and unjust? A man does not call a line crooked unless he has some idea of a straight line. What was I comparing this universe with when I called it unjust? Right? You see the difficulty. If you are going to claim that there is evil, well, evil assumes the existence of good. But if you have some objective standard of good, well, then that becomes a difficulty for the atheist to explain on his worldview. In fact, I think in the Christian worldview explains this very, very nicely. Evil, if evil is a departure from the way things ought to be, or evil is an absence of goodness, well, this implies some kind of objective moral standard or an objective moral law, right? To be evil is to violate that objective moral law. But if you have an objective moral law, where does objective moral law come from? What's the best explanation? Well, when you start thinking through the nature of law, laws only make sense if they are backed by the appropriate authority. Laws only make sense if there's a person of authority behind the law or the command. And this ends up being an argument for God's existence. In fact, Richard Taylor, who is an atheist, he's not a Christian, he's a philosopher, he understands this. He says a duty, right? A moral duty is something that is owed. But something can be owed only to some person or persons. There can be no such thing as a duty in isolation. The concept of moral obligation is unintelligible apart from the idea of God. You can't have moral laws and moral obligations and moral values and moral duties outside of, I think, a theistic framework. Outside of God's existence, it doesn't make sense. You don't have proper grounding or explanation. And so we have a third response. Evil turns out to be evidence for God's existence because evil assumes a moral law. And I think this actually presents a second problem for the atheist. Not only does he have the problem of evil, but he also has the problem of good. How do you explain good? All right, let's look at a fourth response because I think there's more that we can say here. It's what's called the soul-making defense. And the soul-making defense is kind of helping us to put in perspective the God's purposes behind humanity. Now, we live in Western culture, right? We live in America, particularly, that is a society that really shapes us in so many different ways. We're being shaped by not only the communities we grow up in, but we're shaped by, of course, the educational process that we're taken through. We're shaped by the technology now that we spend so much time with. We're shaped by movies and television and media. And we have been shaped and conditioned to think, whether we would explicitly say this or not, we are conditioned, and most Americans actually would explicitly say this, that the purpose of life is happiness. And when you get them to define, when you get Americans to define happiness, happiness actually equals pleasure. Happiness is getting as many pleasurable experiences as possible. Now think about a person who's been conditioned by that, and that's their goal in life. You can see how evil does not fit with that, how suffering does not fit in that view. But what if that is not humanity's purpose? What if that's not God's purpose for humanity, to simply give us all the pleasure that we want? What if his purpose is to make us into a certain kind of person? In fact, think about it. With a child, and I think a lot about this, of course, as a father, but I've come to realize that if ever at every turn my kid asks me for something, and I say, you know what, I want to be a loving father, so I'm going to give them everything they want. That's what loving dads do, right? And so for 18 years of their life, I give them everything they want. We all know how that turns out. You don't turn out with a happy child. You turn out with an unhappy, spoiled child. You turn out with a very shallow kid, a selfish kid. That's not what God is after. God is after something richer and deeper. He's after you. He's after me. He's after our character. God wants to shape us into the kind of beings who can actually, in turn, have a depth of character where then we can go back out into this world and help alleviate the pain and suffering of others, that we can walk with other people, that we can go back into a broken world and walk with that world and offer them the hope of the gospel. But that takes a person with a certain kind of character. That's why the Bible's message is so radical compared to the cultural message. The Bible says in James chapter 1, consider it pure joy, my brothers, whenever you face trials of many kinds. That's an anti-cultural message right there. Consider it pure joy when I go through trials and suffering? Are you kidding me? No. Because you know that the testing of your faith develops perseverance. Perseverance must finish its work so that you may be mature and complete, not lacking anything. God is interested in developing mature human beings. Now, I don't know if you're familiar with the story of Kara Tippetts. Kara Tippetts is her and her husband. He's a pastor. They actually started a church plant in Colorado in 2012. And they go out there, and she kind of started blogging on this. You can actually see her blog at Mundane Faithfulness. But shortly after they went out there, Kara Tippetts was diagnosed with breast cancer. And so she blogged through this. And towards the end of her life, she passed away in March of last year. But towards the end of her life, an interesting thing happened in our culture. A young gal, Brittany, Brittany Maynard was her name. I don't know if you remember the story of Brittany Maynard. She lived in Oregon, and she committed suicide, right? Quote unquote, death with dignity. She took her life because she also was going to die. She had a terminal disease, and so Kara Tippetts actually wrote a letter. You can go to her blog and read it. It's entitled, Dear Brittany, Why We Don't Have to Be So Afraid of Dying and Suffering That We Choose Suicide. And as I kind of read through Kara Tippetts' story and saw some documentaries on her, I came across a video clip that really, I think, captures kind of a radically different perspective on this from someone who actually was going through pain and suffering, but who understood the soul-making defense. I want you to listen to the short clip.
I feel like I'm a little girl at a party whose dad's asking her to leave early, and I'm throwing a fit. I'm not afraid of dying. I just don't want to go. My name is Kara Tippetts. I'm 38 years old. I have four amazing children. And I have been battling cancer for the last 2.5 years.
Our last 2 years have been very stressful. Now having her enter hospice and thinking through what it's going to be like to live life without her.
Kara before cancer was.
I memorized it.
Vivacious and amazing.
No, I answer it.
Okay.
You don't get
it. Was helping you.
She has always been very beautiful to me. Her fun personality. She always loved whoever was in front of her.
You're talking about me in the past tense.
My mom's hair fell out because of chemo, I think.
I had really long, beautiful blonde hair, and I didn't realize how valuable it was to who I was until I lost it. It made me shy in a way I'd never been shy. Who am I without hair, without breasts, without a uterus? Do I still have value?
Mm-hmm. This is not supposed to be the story.
The world says I should be angry, that I should be shaking my fist at God, but I want to be able to share this story that suffering isn't a mistake and it isn't the absence of God's goodness, because He's present in pain.
I got something in my hand. My mom has cancer, and she's had it for a while, and now she's gonna have it for the rest of her life.
In the beginning, we just decided to speak honestly and frankly with the kids, not give them too much that their age can't bear. But all of them now know that mom's dying and that I have cancer.
I don't want you to go.
I know.
We all want more time. We all pray for more time.
Seeing her give back to people and to write her book has inspired me. She's shown me what love is.
I don't want her to leave. I don't want her kids to be without her. I don't want Jason to be without her. I don't want this world to be without her.
Jason shows me the best of what life has to offer, mostly in encouraging me to fight for a soft heart. I know I've got cancer. I know I'm going to die of it. But I also know that I have today, and in this today, I get to live well.
It's tough to watch, but I think it's important to watch, because here you have the model of somebody who doesn't rage against God, but who actually allows the furnace, the pain and suffering and the evil of cancer to shape their character. And here's a beautiful, mature human being walking through pain and suffering. And so we have another response, and the response is that God actually can take something that was not something that he caused, but he can actually redeem it. There's more that we can say. We can talk about the eternal perspective and how that changes our perspective on pain and suffering. And in addition to all of this, the skeptic still has to deal with all the independent arguments we have for God's existence. So we have arguments like the cosmological argument, design arguments, teleological arguments, the argument from consciousness, all these different arguments, and then we can throw that on there, and it seems to me that not only do we have proper response, but we have overwhelming evidence that even in light of evil and suffering, that God still exists, and that we can make sense of it. Now, let me say one last thing here before we take a little break, but The problem of evil is not just a problem for Christians. The problem of evil is not a question that only Christians have to answer. Everybody has to answer the problem of evil. Everyone has to give an account for how they think the world makes sense with evil and suffering. And so you have Bertrand Russell, who's a famous atheist British philosopher, and he's kind of got this kind of famous little quip where he says, no one can believe in a good God if they've sat at the bedside of a dying child. Right? And he kind of pulls on the heartstrings there a little bit, but how can you say to a child who's suffering, there's a good God who's watching this? But I think that we need to turn that question around as well. Because not only do I have to deal with that, but the atheist has to deal with that too. In fact, I have an atheist friend who lives up in the Bay Area. His name is Ricardo. And we've had a number of conversations about these kinds of things. And we were talking about this problem. And I said, Ricardo, as an atheist, I said, what would you say at the bedside of a dying child? And I added this. I said, and what would you say that's consistent with atheism? What would you say at the bedside of a dying child? And he thought about it for a moment, and he looked at me, and he said, well, here's my honest answer. Crap happens. Except he didn't say crap. And I said, thank you. I said, yeah, that is actually an honest answer, and that's consistent with your worldview. Because at the end of the day, if your atheism is true, there is no good, there is no evil, and all of the suffering and that we see in this world has absolutely no meaning. Stuff happens, and then you die, and that's it. End of story. Some people get lucky, but at the end of the day, the universe doesn't care. It's nothing but blind, pitiless indifference, right? And I think we have an answer that is so much more satisfying, that makes sense of it, that answers the challenges, and also offers the solution. Because we know that the story doesn't end with evil and suffering. But we will walk in a world where there is brokenness and evil and suffering, and we know that God has provided the solution. So God isn't the one who's responsible, but because of his love, he has provided the solution to evil and to pain and suffering, and that was the cross of Jesus Christ. In 1 Peter chapter 2, it says, "To this you were called, because Christ suffered for you, leaving you an example that you should follow in his steps. He committed no sin, and no deceit was found in his mouth. When they hurled their insults at him, he did not retaliate. When he suffered, he made no threats. Instead, he entrusted himself to him who judges justly. He himself bore our sins in his body on the tree, so that we might die to sins and live for righteousness. By his wounds, you have been healed." And you know, oftentimes when we talk about evil and suffering, we talk about it out there. But we don't have to go out there to see evil and pain and suffering. We see evil right here. All you have to do is turn inside. And when you and I, in our quiet moments, reflect on our own lives, when I think about my own life, I see plenty of evil right here in my own human heart. And yet God, who is not responsible for my evil, took responsibility for it and paid the price so that I would not have to. And so in his death, we have the solution, the ultimate solution. And in his resurrection, we have the final answer. In 1 Corinthians chapter 15, Paul writes this. And this is the Christian hope. Not only is our answer true, but our answer is hopeful. Paul writes this. He says, "Now I say this, brethren, that flesh and blood cannot inherit the kingdom of God, nor does the perishable inherit the imperishable. Behold, I tell you a mystery. We will not all sleep, but we will all be changed. In a moment, in the twinkling of an eye, at the last trumpet. For the trumpet will sound, and the dead will be raised imperishable, and we will be changed. For this perishable must put on the imperishable, and this mortal must put on immortality. But when this perishable will have put on the imperishable, and this mortal will have put on immortality, then will come about the saying that is written, 'Death is swallowed up in victory.' O death, where is your victory? O death, where is your sting?" The sting of death is sin, and the power of sin is the law. But thanks be to God, who gives us the victory through our Lord Jesus Christ. Those who allow Jesus to take our own evil and pain will be raised imperishable with glorified bodies that will no longer be broken by the evil of this world. And Pastor Dan and Kara Tippetts will have those bodies, and there will come a day when there will be no more evil, no more pain, no more suffering. And so we have the hope of heaven in the Christian worldview. Let me close us in prayer. Lord, thank you for these folks who've come out on a Friday night to think carefully about life's big questions. And I pray for those of us in here who may actually be wrestling with this, wrestling with you. I pray that you would grant them grace, that you would help them to understand that you're okay with the wrestling, you're okay with the struggling. I pray that you might continue to bring people into their lives who can walk through them, walk with them through their own trials. But I pray ultimately, God, that we would find the truth in you. And we would see that the only hope in a broken world with evil and suffering is the hope of Christ. And for those of us, Lord, who are faithful followers of Christ, I pray that we would continue to go back out into this world and proclaim that good news. And we pray these things in the name of Christ. Amen.